This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Back over on YouTube, folks are saying, you know, Fox is essentially complicit in the next violent act. Interesting perspective. Cameron Jordan is tweeting, retweeting Donald Trump. Donald Trump had tweeted, the NFL players are at it again, taking a knee when they should be standing proudly for the national anthem. Cameron Jordan tweets that and says, comments on it, says, a guy who won the presidential election, how about we get, don't call him Mr. President, how about we get a statement on the Unite the Right rally being held, to be held in D.C. this weekend, a year after the first one in Charlottesville. I don't think you're going to hear from that. He says, only way to say it, what a goober. He is who I thought he was. Guy is 70 years old, acting out what was once the highest, in what was once the highest respected political position as an overly insecure prepubescent child. He won't govern himself. Give him a mentor. Right. Members of his cabinet left on their own accord or were dismissed accordingly. But what do I know? I'm just a guy who should stick to football. Cameron Jordan, you know, when you have sports figures calling out the president for his behavior, shall we say, I think that it's a time for us to go, really? Buck in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Buck, what's up?
Yes, Tom, I want to talk some about the national anthem problem.
Mm-hmm.
And my take on it is that African Americans never were part of the American dream. They were brought to this country as slaves, and they were not citizens. So from the get-go, they were not citizens, and so they were in the American dream. My solution to this whole thing, or a possible solution, would be for the National Football League to take the whole season off with a paid leave and give everybody time to sit down and work out some sort of an agreement on this, or this thing is going to drag on forever, because I noticed that the players are already in the preseason starting to amp it up, and they got a point. And I think if they took the whole season off, I think that would give them satisfaction that they had made a point.
Yeah.
You know?
Buck, it's not going to happen. I mean, there's billions of dollars on the line here, and the billionaire owners of the NFL teams are not going to put up with that. But the thing that I think we need to keep reminding ourselves is that this phony patriotism, these ostentatious displays of patriotism, the flag, the national anthem, planes flying over, you know, all the rah-rah, hoop-de-doop, this all started out because the Army wanted to use the NFL games for recruiting purposes and spiffed the NFL, you know, I mean, literally gave millions of dollars to the owners of these teams via the league in exchange for the teams trotting their players out on the field to stand respectfully while the national anthem is being played. And the planes were flying over. I mean, this literally was a recruiting effort by the military, and it only started 10, 15 years ago. And, you know, during this time of crisis when the military has been broken by George W. Bush lying us into two wars. And if we were to simply say, okay, you know, we're not taking money from the military anymore. We don't need to do this whole, you know, 15-minute, you know, patriotic song and dance. We're here to watch a football game, not for a pep rally for America. And, you know, nothing wrong with pep rallies for America, but, you know, that's not what I pay for when I buy a ticket to a football game. I go to watch football.
Yeah. Well, it may not happen. You know, I mean, that's a real long shot to say something like that. But, boy, you know, nobody's working on any kind of solutions on it.
Yeah. And, I think the simple solution is to say, you know, we're not going to do this anymore. Buck, thanks a lot for the call. Tony in Fort Worth, Texas. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Good afternoon, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
The comment on the previous caller from Texas, I think
Billy
Barry. When he mentioned prayerful people, it put a little thought in my mind. Okay, where were these prayerful people when we had ministers in the pulpit and these same prayerful people calling for the demise of our country because we had a black president?
Or where were these prayerful people when Dylann Roof walks into a black church in, I think it was South Carolina, wasn't it? And murders nine African Americans, including two or three pastors who just happened to be there specifically to pray.
and congregating in these same prayerful churches when we had these prayerful white ministers praying to God for an assassin's bullet to end the life of President Obama and the First Lady. Why were they so quiet then, but now because...
Tony, I don't remember that. What am I missing here?
There was a minister. I will look it up and I'll try and get it back to your screener.
Yeah.
But he actually was praying for an assassin to kill President Obama.
Yeah. See, I don't think that it probably happened. I'm not saying it didn't, but I don't think that is representative.
Oh, I know.
You know, broadly. I mean, the calling for the assassination of the president. That is like. I mean, well, on the other hand, you know, these guys are out there openly calling for, you know, calling for policies anyway that lead to hate and violence and death. And,
exactly.
You know, so, yeah, it's the dividing line is not clear. I mean, it's all kind of one blurry spectrum. So, you know,
it seems like a double standard. It's okay for the right to say whatever they want about our party and our candidates. But when we point out the facts of what their party and their candidates are doing, then it's hate.
Yeah, yeah. Interesting point. Tony, thank you for the call. Remarkable. Sharon in Northern California. Hey, Sharon, what's up?
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I'm well. What's on your mind?
Let me put this off speaker. I'm still hearing the other guy.
Okay.
Okay. I'm calling about, I'm very concerned. I used to like MSNBC and CNN, but now all they do is talk about Trump. And I'm really worried because I'll once in a while turn to Fox News, and they have a more appealing picture. It seems like they really go all out to have a very alluring picture that you can watch, the colors, everything.
Yeah,
and then they have news, and then they have news that CNN and MSNBC doesn't have.
Yeah, trying to find news on a Sunday night in the United States. The only place you can find it is Fox News.
Yeah, yeah. And I'm really concerned that it's going to turn into 2016 all over again because, you know, even, you know, regular people might turn on Fox News not even knowing what the politics is about it and see the news and then hear the spiel in between the news, and they might stick with Fox News because CNN and MSNBC, I just wish they would get it.
Yeah, and you know? I wish they would stop doing the same four stories every hour all day long. I mean
they're turning people off.
Yeah.
I
do know, and I agree, and it concerns me. And CNN is sitting on the headline news channel, and at least they could turn that into headline news. I mean, that's the name of it, for goodness sake. Sharon, thank you. Very, very, very well said. Anthony, I've mangled this name before, Anthony. How do you what's the name of your town in California?
Hi, Tom. It's called Tehachapi, California.
Tehachapi,
Indian name.
You thank you.
You're welcome, Tom. First of all, Tom, I want to thank you for the public service that you do for this country because you're ice skating uphill, and you need to get DNA tested. I think you got Walter Cronkite genes in your body.
Thank you, Anthony. That's a high compliment. What's up?
You're welcome. Tom, I think we have a way we can kind of solve these race relations problems in this country is, one, I think we should have conscription in this country because only 10% of the people serve in the armed forces.
I agree, and it's not even 10% now, Anthony. It's down into single digits.
Wow. And see, when you're in the service, Tom, you're forced to eat, sleep, and you know what, with people of different races, nationalities, religions.
Yep.
So you have more skin in the game. And then you realize, like, hey, this person's just like me. The only thing we have is the same is just the uniform that you're wearing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And
agreed.
Also, Tom, I'll be 54 next week, and I was born and raised in South Central Los Angeles. And when I was growing up, they had bus. I don't know if they still have it now, but we had busing where we went. I was bused out to some of the most expensive schools in Los Angeles.
Mm-hmm.
And we didn't know anything about race until when I was in middle school, when the Ruth series came out by Alex Haley.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if you remember that scene when Kunta Kinte was whipped because he didn't want to change his name to Toby.
Right.
And when we went back to school the next day, we had a riot at the school because we had, in the history books back then, they didn't tell you anything about slavery.
Wow.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And but two more things. I know I'm going to be quick. I used to work in prison. I retired. And everything in prison is about race. You segregate it, right? Everyone's, mm-hmm. they stay with the race. But I was a teacher in there. And, like, the Aryan Nation, the Ku Klux Klan guys, they didn't want to, they had to listen to me because I was in charge of them, right?
Mm-hmm.
But once we have a conversation, we all used to talk. We used to have a powwow together because most of them people, they didn't want to be in the class, but they know they can get time off their sentence. So we would just have conversations. And then they would realize that we're all the same. We're just, you know, the only thing you have is different is the pigmentation in your skin.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, Tom, finally, people... have you ever seen the movie White Man's Burden starring Harold Belafonte and John Travolta? It was back in, I think, 96 or 97.
I have not. I've heard about it, but I have not seen
okay.
it.
Okay. What it is a race reversal where all the people of color, the black people, they were the people in power and rich and everything, and all the white people were poor and living in the projects. People should need to see that movie.
Hmm.
And then they will have a different aspect on, you know, this race thing.
Yeah.
Because that's what's destroying our country, Tom.
Fascinating. White Man's Burden. I'll
White
have to check it out.
Burden.
Yeah,
I
wonder.
John Travolta and Harry Belafonte.
Yeah, it's probably on Netflix now or Amazon or whatever. Anthony, thank you. Thanks.
Thanks, you, Tom.
Thanks for all the tips and thanks for your kind words and thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. We'll be right back. It's 17 and a half minutes past the hour here on the Tom Hartman Program, home of the political revolution. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with more of Anything Goes Friday after this. And welcome back. Paula in Coos Bay, Oregon, watching us on Facebook Live. Hey, Paula, what's up?
Hi, Bill.
Tom.
I'm just outraged. I read an article, and then I looked it up, and... that Trump has given power to some of his cronies at Mar-a-Lago to run the Veterans Administration.
Yeah,
and
it's mind-boggling.
They've been doing it for months.
No, they've been doing it since the first month of the administration. They've been doing it for 18 months.
Oh, my God.
Yeah.
What? These men have never served in the military. They're
That's
not
right.
politicians. They're his cronies.
Yep.
They're members of Mar-a-Lago. Oh, I'm so outraged.
Yeah.
I have family members who depend on Veterans Administration, and now I understand why they're in such dire straits.
Yep. I mean, this is the most recent reason why they're in such dire straits. But the VA mostly is in dire straits right now because George W. Bush declared two illegal wars, lied us into two illegal wars,
and never
appropriated the funding for the Veterans Administration in anticipation of the returning casualties, you know, not just dead, but injured and wounded. And
how can we continue to send our boys and girls over to fight for senseless wars and be injured and killed and come over here and we tell them to, you're not priority.
Yep. Yeah, it's a serious problem, Paula. We've got at all different kinds of levels. We had a caller earlier who was suggesting we should go back to the draft, and I agree with that. I think the back end of it should be we should do it the way that it was being done in Germany in the 80s when I lived there. I don't know if they still are, but at that time, because we were living next door to the Salem International Program, and you know, nonprofit, and you could either do a year in the military or you could do a year of service in a nonprofit, in a hospital, in a community for abused kids, in a, you know, a library, whatever, you know, volunteer. But you had to pick one or the other, and you had to, you know, take that year, and typically kids left their homes. And it was a rite of passage, it was an important and necessary thing. And then you get more diversity in the military, particularly economic diversity, when you also have wealthy people in the military. And if everybody, frankly, I don't think George Bush would have been successful in lying us into the war in Afghanistan or lying us into the war in Iraq if we had had a draft. I think the American people would have said, hey, wait a minute, you want to draft my son or daughter and send them off to fight in a war that you can't even justify to us, really? Or you're trying to lie?
Really?
You know, yeah.
yeah.
And I think that the Veterans Administration would not be broken right now if we didn't have an all-volunteer military, because it's easier to take advantage of people when you can essentially pay them off. And that, I mean, they've got enlistment, re-enlistment bonuses now that are running as high as $90,000. That's how hard they have to work to get people to stay in the military. And when you've got people...
I have a granddaughter who's in the Army right as we speak, and I'm worried census about her.
Yeah.
And I have two grandsons who have served, and they're now out. And one has a prosthetic leg, and he's having all kinds of problems with VA.
Yeah.
And I just, he didn't question when they sent him over there. He did what was called and expected of him, and he comes home and he's told, thanks a lot, go away.
Yeah, and he's missing his leg too. I'm so sorry to hear that, Paula. Thank you for calling and sharing your story with us and your perspective. It's spot on. It's spot on. Thank you so much. And we'll be right back. Welcome back. Mary in Spokane Valley, Washington. Hey, Mary, what's up?
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Thanks for watching us on Facebook.
I'm going to hopefully hit on a couple topics real quick that you've just covered today.
Please pick one.
First of all, when we were talking about who's in charge of America, and you were talking about the one book where they talk about corporate being taken over, corporate America, nobody talks about the Gridiron Club that was founded in 1885 in Washington, D.C., and they've basically put every president in office since their forming and have had the presidential dinner every year since their form. Nobody's
I think you're confusing cause and effect. Just because you've got a good old boys club doesn't mean that they're electing presidents.
If you look into their history, I've been studying the Gridiron Club for quite some time and how they were developed and who's been in office. Even during the Depression, the president at the time ordered the Gridiron Club guard to go to the storage bins that were for the people right in the middle of the Depression and to steal the food out of there for their party so they could continue having wine.
Yeah, but that doesn't mean that you've got a club that's controlling America or electing presidents.
Well, it's
they may behave reprehensibly, but
it's 100% created by the media.
Okay.
And then there's the Chisholm versus Georgia case that closed the federal courts to any citizen suing another state for contaminating or destroying their land or ability to life, land, liberty, and property in pursuit of happiness. And it also gave birth to the 11th Amendment and the Neutrality Act. We need to stop thinking about new legislation and start overturning any case laws that have taken away our rights as citizens.
Hmm.
And then finally,
I want to try and limit calls to one topic. Thank you very much. Dave in Federal Way, Washington. Hey, Dave, sorry I blew it trying to put you on the air earlier. I'm glad you were able to get back in. What's up?
Yeah, that's okay. Hey, Tom, I stumbled into a slight disagreement with you the other day, and I ran out of time because I started rambling on about George W. Bush.
Mm-hmm.
But it's an important point. I can make it quickly, all right, because I've
okay.
you know, condensed my thoughts. Hey, this... You know, out of politeness or decency, I think people are giving President Trump the benefit of the doubt when he said he's not going to engage in regime change or a doctrine of regime change.
You're talking with regard to Iran?
Well, I think it's global. We are still what Trump is doing is a hybrid form of regime change, where there is an application of soft power and a preparation to do extreme hard power if necessary to force regime change. And the reason why I think it's important for people to consider that is, like, all right, for instance, Fareed Zakaria interviewed Premier Nguyen, a few years ago. And President Nguyen of China said that America's economy is solid and that America is the only superpower. Now, if I analyzed that and I looked into it at the time, I think what he was saying is as long as America doesn't do regime change to China, China will not do regime change to the United States. But now it looks like this Trump administration is targeting both Russia and China for soft power regime change, and it's dangerous.
Yeah. I respectfully disagree, Dave, but we'll have to do this another time. We're hitting a break.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-808-9925.
Anything Goes Friday. Back with more of your calls right after this. Okay, one of the deep and profound questions coming out of our Facebook page today. If avocados are berries, does that make guacamole jam? And Nate actually Googled it, and avocados apparently are berries. Really? I just got an email from Ted Deutsch. Ted Deutsch is the member of the House of Representatives, Democratic member of the House of Representatives who represents Parkland, Florida, among other places, or Parkland, I guess it's probably pronounced, the place of the horrific shooting. And the guy who's running against him, his name is, and I'm not sure if he's anglicized the pronunciation of his name or if he pronounces it in the Spanish way. It's M-A-N-J-A-R-R-E-S, whether it's Manjeres or Manjeres, I don't know. But Javier Manjeres is the Republican. And Ted Deutsch says, Marco Rubio has endorsed in our race. It's not surprising he didn't pick me. Who he picked, however, is disturbing. Here's who Senator Rubio is endorsing. According to the Palm Beach Post, in 2016, Rubio's pick was arrested for battery and attempted murder after beating a man and firing three bullets into his truck. The South Florida Sentinel, Sun Sentinel, reported that he called the brave survivors of the Parkland shooting school a disgrace and accused a grieving father of exploiting his child's death for political purposes. He has had 14 domestic violence and stalking cases charged against him in the past 10 years, according to the Palm Beach Post. Where do Republicans come up with these people? Oh, that's right. This is the Republican base. I get it. So this is just, you know, where we go with this. Authoritarianism, by the way, Donald Trump's lawyer has said that the president is above the law, essentially. Meanwhile, Rudy Giuliani keeps coming out with this, well, you know, we're negotiating with Mueller and he's saying this and we're saying that, but we haven't heard a single word from Mueller. So it could be, and I think it probably is, that Rudy Giuliani is really just making this stuff up, all, you know, just out of whole cloth. I don't know why Mueller doesn't just issue a subpoena. Well, actually, I think I do know why. Either A, he's not yet ready, or B, he's going to wait until after the elections. And yes, I get it, Donald Trump is not on the ticket. And I get it that it's not a law or a rule even that you don't go after a candidate within 60 days of the election. It's a broad policy, but it's not even a written policy anywhere. It's just something we all understand. And I can hear all of you right now saying, well, what about Jim Comey 2 weeks before the presidential election saying, oh, it's time for us to investigate more of Hillary Clinton's emails. And then a week before the election's going, oops, nothing new there on Anthony Weiner's computer. Sorry, shouldn't have mentioned that. You know, we know that that cost Hillary Clinton probably the election. And, you know, So Mueller is probably going to be a little more cautious than Jim Comey was. But, you know, does democracy allow for this kind of authoritarianism for the president's lawyer to say, you know, well, he should be above the law, you know, of course. And let's put a guy on the Supreme Court who thinks the president's above the law, too. That's what we need. Yeah. And then you get Devin Nunes, along with Kathy McMorris Rodgers at a fundraiser and, a bunch of rich fat cats. And a progressive organization actually made a donation to get in the room and record this, which is hysterical. And Devin Nunes saying, well, you know, yeah, what the president did is apparently a crime. It's like, you know, soliciting, hacked emails from a foreign government. Yeah, that's a crime. But we've got to get Brett Kavanaugh on the Supreme Court, so that the president's crimes can be covered up, presumably. Before we do anything else, really. And then, finally, there's this attack on Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez that is in today's Washington Post. And this, this really troubled me. I mean, I read this and I thought, this is just wrong. And I'll share it with you. Glenn Kessler writing in the Washington Post, the so-called fact checker analysis. And she says, she was asked, you know, what about the cost of government-funded health care? You know, this canard, this lie that is always put out that, if the government does Medicare for all, that's going to cost more than we're spending right now, which is a lie. It'll cost at least 20% less, and most estimates are as much as 50% less than what we're spending right now. So anyhow, they asked her that, and she replied, somewhat flippantly, but I think that spot on. She said, well, why aren't we incorporating the cost of all the funeral expenses of those who died because they can't afford access to health care? That's part of the cost of our system. And Glenn Kessler, in a very sarcastic, goes, huh? Question mark? H-U-H question mark? Several readers asked us to vet some of her claims. What do you mean, huh? Harvard University says 40,000 people a year were dying because of lack of access to health care in the United States before Obamacare, and it's probably down to around 17,000 a year right now. The Charlene Dills of our country. And you're going to go after Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez for pointing this out? Really? Another one that they're going after her for saying, this is an interview on PBS's Firing Line. She said, unemployment is low because everyone has two jobs. Unemployment is low because people are working 60, 70, 80 hours a week and can barely feed their family. She said, everyone has two jobs. Well, this is how people talk. And they're saying, well, this is an example of sweeping language. Everyone has two jobs. According to the Bureau of Labor Statistics, not everyone has two jobs. Do you think? Come on. Then she goes on and she says, ICE is the only criminal investigative agency, the only enforcement agency in the United States that has a bed quota. So ICE is required to fill 34,000 beds with detainees every single night, and that number has only been increased since 2009. And they say, as our friends at PolitiFact documented, this is an urban legend. No, it's not an urban legend. You know, at least from what I heard last night, Sean, what's the name of the guy who wrote that report on ICE? Franklin Foer, thank you. Wrote this brilliant article for The Atlantic. He was being interviewed last night by Terry Gross on her, and I'm sure it's on her podcast now. He put this stuff together, and yeah, no, it's true. It's real. So anyhow, but back to your calls. I forgive me for going off on a rant here. But Chris in Albuquerque. Hey, Chris, what's up?
Hi, Tom. It's an honor to speak to you. This is my first time calling.
Thank you.
Just a quick trip down memory lane, since there's only one topic of it. I can only speak about one topic.
Thank you.
I was 13 years old. I was going first year of junior high school, 12 or 13, I can't remember now. It was two white kids on a computer at Sears. And I was with my mom, and I wanted to know what they were, you know, I was just curious because I was a kid. They were the same age as me. And I went to the same computer, and it was in, go home, we used you, go back, you're not welcome.
You mean they had typed this stuff on the computer, or they said these things to you?
They said it. No, they actually put it on the computer. They wanted everyone to see. They wanted everyone to see at Sears. It was at the Sears Merchant Center. I can't remember. I should have told you from the beginning. I'm from Montgomery, Alabama.
Uh-huh.
I'm from born and raised. I've been in Albuquerque for 11 years, and I'm learning from this perspective also. And anyway, back to that again. I was stigmatized. I was kind of like, I was stunned. It would shock me.
Yeah.
Because I had no idea. I knew about race. I knew kids were different color, whatever. I knew that, but I didn't have a deep-rooted hatred of anybody.
And this experience wounded you? This experience wounded you?
It wounded me. It totally wounded me because I thought, you know, other white kids thought the same thing.
Yeah.
And when I went to the first year of junior high, I played football, white, black, Asian, I mean, different races.
Mm-hmm.
And I learned that, wow, I got along with these kids. No matter what race, no matter, we were the same. And that, even though that stigmatized me, that actually inherited me to grow in a relationship at that time, it didn't take long for me to recover. It didn't take long for me to understand, no matter what color, we won't, you know, no matter what color what kids are, or no matter what color people in general are, we try to think the same thing. I'm not saying we are monolithic people, you know, even in our own community, even blacks don't think the same. We have our different biases. You know, when I hear people on TV, you know, like a news reporter, you know, interviews a guy and he talks a little bit of bonics or talks of slang or whatever, I cringe. You know, we're talking about the black community. Like I said, we're not a monolithic people. Yeah. We don't think the same. We have different ideas. We have different thoughts. And when I moved here 11 years ago, I noticed, you know, being around Hispanics also, I know they think they're not a monolithic people also.
Right.
They don't think the same, because when I moved here, I asked one Hispanic guy I was working with, are you from Mexican descent? This guy got offended. He was mad.
Huh.
And I was like, I didn't know what to take of it, because, like I said, I only was here for a year.
Mm-hmm.
I was trying to get to know this gentleman, and he got so offended. And he said, first thing came out of his mouth, first thing he said was, I'm Spanish. I had no idea, had no concept that me simply saying, are you from Mexican descent? I know history. I know a lot of the southern South America was native.
Yeah.
Indigenous people.
Well, there's a racial hierarchy in the South. I mean, I saw this when I worked in Colombia and Peru and in Mexico. That people who are of mostly Spanish ancestry and have mostly, you know, European looking white looking characteristics, they are the ones who end up on TV. They're the ones who end up basically running the power structure, and you know, as opposed to people who look like they're indigenous. And yes. Yeah, it's.
I seen that when I was overseas also, and I. I'm sorry. I know you're going to break.
Yeah, thank we
you.
Are.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks thank a lot, Chris. Great to hear from you.
Uh-huh.
I appreciate it. Yeah, we're hitting a break here. We're going to pick up Talk Media News in 4 minutes. So stick around. It's the Tom Hartman Program, helping you win the water cooler wars, or to have a reasonable conversation with, you know, crazy Uncle Ralph around Thanksgiving dinner. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back with more of your calls, but immediately we'll be back with Talk Media News. Stick around. And welcome back. KJ in Jacksonville, Florida. Hey, KJ, thanks for watching us on Free Speech TV. What's up?
Thank you for taking my call, Tom. Sure. This is the first time calling. I'm just calling to point out the hypocrisy with conservatives whenever they say that NFL players are not protected by free speech, but then they say that Alex Jones is protected by free speech when YouTube, and when YouTube is a private company as well,
right?
And with the NFL as a private company, I just think that's very hypocritical of them.
Well, none of them are actually protected by free speech. You know, the First Amendment protects you from the government impeding your free speech. But the fact of the matter is, right now, most of the agencies, as it were, that can work to inhibit your ability to speak freely, like Facebook, Twitter, and whatnot, are private corporations. And you have no right to force a corporation to give you a platform.
But I just think that conservatives, whenever they talk about defending free speech, they usually do it whenever it's like convenient to them.
Yeah, they're outrageous selective. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's pretty much what I wanted to talk about.
Okay. Well said, KJ. Well said. I completely agree. Thank you very much. Gene in Savoy, Illinois. Hey, Gene, what's up?
Hi. You are my hero. I have so many questions, but I'll narrow it down to a couple. The first one is, if it's proven that Trump is an illegitimate president, why do we allow Neil Gorsuch to stay on the Supreme Court? Is this a flaw in our Constitution? That's one question. The second one is it true that the governors are getting ready to have a big conference and the underlying purpose is to change our Constitution? Have you heard anything about that?
Yeah. The Gorsuch first, I think that Trump is an illegitimate president. I think that he became president as a result of, in part, the electioneering of and possibly more than one, I think probably more than one, actually, foreign government. And frankly, I think that all the big money that was behind Trump and all the other Republicans, coming from a fewer than 1,000 major, you know, billionaire and multimillionaire donors and large corporations, should also tell us that there's an illegitimate aspect to his presidency. But there is no provision in the Constitution to determine that, you know, outside of the impeachment clause. once an election has been called. So, you know, we've got to deal with that.
So is that a major flaw in our Constitution? I keep thinking that this has happened more than once,
mm-hmm.
and now our legal system is, they're going after our legal system, and they're controlling yeah. who gets in the Supreme Court. And I'm wondering, what's the fix? I mean, what would you change about our Constitution to
well,
keep
I would,
this from happening again?
I would get money out of politics, and, you know, whether it's foreign money or whether it's domestic money. But, you know, we have had a series of, I don't think that we've had a legitimately elected Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower. You know, Richard Nixon, you know, blew up LBJ's Vietnam War peace negotiations in 1968 to become president. Ronald Reagan held, you know, worked with the Iranians to hold the hostages for a whole year to sabotage Jimmy Carter to become president. You know, George W. Bush got the Supreme Court to put him in as president. You know, and Donald Trump had help from the billionaires and the Russians. I mean, it's pretty straightforward. We have not had a legitimately elected Republican president since Dwight Eisenhower. Gene, thank you for the call. We'll be right back. Let's check in with Talk Media News and find out what's going on in the world today. This report is underwritten by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and Ellen Ratner's new book, Loving What You Do. And on the line with us is Luke Vargas, the senior foreign correspondent of Talk Media News and working out of New York. You can follow him on Twitter at The Courier. Luke, what's going on in the world today?
Hey, Tom, watching a few things. The first was a kind of interesting letter that the North Korean Foreign Ministry released yesterday evening from the country's mission to the United Nations, sort of one of the few very active diplomatic facilities at the United Nations. Typically, this stuff would come out of Washington, but North Korea operates a little differently. They have a small diplomatic office up in New York, and they use pretty frequently, or have through the years, to put out documents, often without addressing them to anyone in particular, but that try and shift U.S. opinion on the North Korean nuclear issue. And they've done this again in a letter that really seems to be directed at President Trump. Hopping above all American diplomats and writing something right to the president in which North Korea really says, hey, Mr. Trump, we respect the fact that you were so friendly to us in Singapore and that we had such good, such a good relationship there. Mm-hmm. But all these other officials, your senior foreign officials are breaking the decorum. They are, still being hostile to us. They're still, you know, when asked about sanctions and stuff, still say, hey, we're going to keep the sanctions on. North Korea isn't compliant yet, and we need to wait and see. And they're basically spinning all of this against these senior officials in a way that seems pretty clearly designed to me to try and sow distrust on Trump's part about whether or not his, you know, people like Mike Pompeo or who have some delegated authority on foreign policy and national security aren't undermining the president. They want to talk just to Trump.
So you think they're
the reasons are pretty clear there, yeah.
They're basically whining to Trump, you know, your people don't treat us well, you know, and asking him to slap them into line or asking him to cut them out of the loop?
Yeah, you remember they did this with John Bolton several months after he was appointed before the Singapore talks. That was the cause for a whole week's worth of headlines about whether the summit was actually going to continue. A story I didn't make too much about because at the time I still kept getting emails from the White House saying, hey, you know, sign up for this part of the Singapore trip. They were obviously still planning for it, but the North, you know, we allowed the summit to get quote unquote postponed or called off potentially because the North Koreans wrote a letter saying John Bolton is playing mean. We'd rather have, you know, nice guy Mr. Trump to talk to. But let's bear in mind, there's a reason they want Mr. Trump. And Trump is the only person who's given North Korea a meaningful concession, which was that sort of throw-in deal, as Trump called it, in Singapore, to call off the joint drills with the South Koreans. And now they're looking at people like Mike Pompeo giving a speech earlier this week saying, from everything we can tell, it might be years before we even can properly evaluate whether North Korea is complying with what was agreed to in Singapore. And one more item on this that I'll throw in is that Alex Ward, a journalist over at Fox, VOX, did a great scoop earlier this week, I think it was on Wednesday, where he revealed that one reason why the North Koreans are probably very frustrated about continuing to deal with Pompeo and not go right to Trump, which is that Pompeo, in private encounters with the North Koreans, has been demanding that, and this is the way the U.S. frames it, and it needs some air quotes around it, a down payment on denuclearization. The North Koreans should immediately, or within the next 18 months or so, give up 60 to 70% of all their nuclear warheads. and without even saying when pressed over and over on this, what the U.S. and other countries would agree to do in return. So, you know, there seems to be a thinking among everyone other than Trump that this is going to need to be a process where the North Koreans have to do something major quickly, whereas Trump is willing to declare these relatively minor sort of goodwill gestures to be, you know, sufficient for the time being. So, you know, I think they're probably be worried that if this process is left in Pompeo's hands, left in Bolton's hands, North Korea is going to be forced to keep turning down these U.S. demands, and that could trip up the whole process of having pressure relieved on them. So, yeah. Interesting letter. I think North Korea's the tactics here are pretty clear.
Fascinating stuff. What else is up?
I've been watching the fact that the U.S. has hit Turkey with new tariffs today, doubling steel and aluminum tariffs against that country at a time when Turkey is really having financial problems and at a time when this U.S.-Turkish relationship is not going great for a whole host of reasons. We can talk about that just in the context of Turkey, which has had its economy, or its the lira, tumble about 40% this year already. It dove a further 20% today after Trump doubled these tariffs, forcing President Erdogan over in Turkey to go on TV, give a public address, and urge citizens to buy the currency. I mean, it's certainly sort of desperate times for him.
Yeah.
I think another thing that's confusing markets about this decision is that the U.S. and Turkey are having a spat right now over this pastor, an American pastor that they've arrested, saying he's guilty of espionage, and the U.S. demanding that he be released immediately. And so this there's this tendency to sort of actually sort of minimize the fallout from this Turkish announcement because you say, look, this is a political statement. But at the same time, I think there's justifiable panic in other areas that have been hit by the steel and aluminum tariffs. You know, Korea and Japan initially, Canada, the European Union, which Juncker, when he did his little visit to the U.S. a few weeks ago, thought he'd settled that issue. But now he's wondering, maybe there is more to this. Maybe Trump is just not seeing the returns he wants on his tariff agenda, and he's willing to just tighten the screws across the board. And maybe all of these, quote-unquote, settled matters relating to existing steel and aluminum tariffs are now being reopened, and we could see our steel and aluminum tariffs doubled, too. So, again, what might otherwise have been a somewhat local economic panic in Turkey, I think, has sent markets lower today because we just don't know where Trump is, you know, how close he is to, you know, saying uncle on the tariffs. And this shows us we could be entering another chapter.
Yeah, specifically with regard to Turkey, reading this story, it occurred to me that I'm wondering, I guess, and I'll pose this as a question to you. Is Trump now in a position where he is torn between, you know, on the one hand, his love of an authoritarian leader, Erdogan, his love of, I believe there's a Trump Tower or Trump property in Ankara in Turkey, and, you know, his relationship with Erdogan. I mean, you know, when he was over there for the NATO summit, Erdogan was the guy that he was walking around holding hands with and talking to, or, you know, patting on the back and whatnot. Between that loyalty, that kind of personal and financial loyalty, and the religious right that is hassling him, is that what's going on?
Yeah, I would say in a sentence that this might be the Pence camp that is pushing back against Erdogan, whereas it might be the Pompeo camp that's making the president's job hard with North Korea. But I think the Christian element here can't be ignored.
Makes perfect sense. Luke Vargas, thank you, Luke.
Thank you.
We'll be back with more right after this. Stick around.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.